We actually have an additional board to add as well, the Board of Podiatric Medicine. So, the we'll start actually without a quorum, and then hopefully continue as a quorum later. So the first presentation is from the Board of Optometry and the Board of Dietetic and Nutrition Practice. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Lori Mickelson. I'm the Executive Director for two separate licensing boards, the Board of Optometry and the Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice. They are both small licensing boards. The Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice has 1,315 licensees right now. We are one of six small licensing boards that have a collaborative project going regarding our databases, our online services for our licensees. The complaints that we receive are few in number for dietetics and nutrition, but they do have, they become very complex because of the nature of the profession. Our current collaborative efforts regarding our databases and online include online renewals, online access to change personal information, addresses, phone numbers, contact information, and also to record continuing education on an ongoing basis throughout the year. Our licensees comment that the online renewal system is a simple process and very easy to navigate. They also enjoy the ability to record their continuing education throughout the year as they attend continuing education. Our budget for dietetics and nutrition practice has not changed. Our one request for a change was the continuation of a fee reduction for our annual license renewal fees that was in our budget from 2005 through 2009. And we requested that that be continued for another 4 years, and that is part of the governor's recommendations for the budget. I will answer any questions anyone may have on the Board of Dietetics. Otherwise, I will move on to the Board of Optometry.
Ms. Nixon, let me see if I understand. The reduction is what's continued or is not continued?
The fee reduction is part of the governor's recommendations for the next biennium to reduce the annual renewal fee for dietetics and nutrition practice.
And this is it was reduced previously, and this is to continue the reduction? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. In 2005, it was approved for a four-year period, and that period expired with our renewals in 2008. So we need to we requested it to be continued, and it is part of the governor's budget to continue that reduction.
And just a follow-up on that, are you serving fewer people, or is there, how are you able to do it with a reduced fee is my question.
This is a fairly new licensing board. It was established in 1995, and the estimated number of licensees at that time was 500 based on the exemptions that exist in the law. And now we have 1,000 licensees. So our projections from 1995 to current we exceed those expectations. So we just have more income than we had anticipated originally.
I guess the logical question would be, can you get by with us? Or do you need the complement that you have now?
With the proposed fees that are included in the governor's budget, we can operate adequately.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, if not, why don't you go ahead and go on to the next board?
Similarly, the Board of Optometry has 1,019 licensees currently, and once again, the Board of Optometry is part of that sixth board collaborative effort regarding online renewals. We continue to get good feedback from our licensees regarding the services available online. Our complaints although low, continue to increase, and we have a broader range of complaint issues that come before us. The fees for the Board of Optometry were last established and raised in 1995, and we have not raised the fees since then. I will also answer any questions you might have regarding the Board of Optometry.
I do have one question in regard to the complaints being more frequent and broader. Could you just elaborate a little bit, like what kind of complaints are you getting that are they more serious? Are they
not serious? They tend to be more the optometrists, I believe, are under more pressure to do more examinations in a shorter period of time, and consumers are concerned with the time that doctors are spending and their personalities while they're providing those services. So it's more trying to make the customer happy and moving forward and getting more clients through their office.
And I think what I'm reading between the lines is, are people feeling like they're not getting enough time with their optometrists?
Yes, that would be true. We have a number of optometrists who work in commercial settings, and much of their responsibilities are to see as many clients in a day that they can.
I would guess when they're on consignment and they make more, a higher income if they rush people through and see more people. Is that fair to say?
That could be a good way to put it, yes.
Well, what are the increased number of complaints? What are we talking about here in terms of?
We have gone in the last biennium from about 20 per year to about 35. But they're not all that particular issue. There's others. We have consumers sometimes are not very happy with the product that they purchase. For instance, they have an eye examination and they take their prescription and they have eyeglasses made from that prescription, and the eyeglasses do not come back to them that enhance their vision, and they complain about that. And it tends to be more the lab that's creating the lenses than it is the services provided by the optometrist. The examination and the prescription is adequate, but the lab that is producing the lens is not producing the correction in the right level of the eye frame, and the consumer just is not able to use the glasses. This is outside the scope of what we regulate. Excuse me. Optometrists, we regulate the professional services provided by the optometrist, not the product that is sold once the examination is complete.
Well, Mr. Clifton, what is the recourse for a consumer then who has a prescription that doesn't work for them?
Madam Chair, we direct them to the Consumer Division of the State Attorney General's Office or other Better Business Bureau agencies that can assist them in their retrieval of fees for glasses that are not adequate for them.
And do you happen to know what the outcome might be for that?
I believe that it's quite positive because the optometrists become aware that the board has been notified of this, and they then work with their labs to assist their clients with the resources and the replacement of those lenses.
So, Ms. Nicholson, who is responsible for that consumer protection? Is that Department of Commerce, or who is it that regulates those facilities?
I'm not aware that the labs are regulated by any of the state agencies.
Do we know how many of those labs are in-state and how many might be out-state?
Well, I'm familiar with about 5 labs that are within the state. If there are more, I'm not aware of them.
Okay, any other questions from any members? I actually want to let you know that I intend to follow up on this. I've certainly got complaints from constituents who've had this kind of problem, particularly older constituents
yes.
who are needing to have changes in glasses because of reading issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very costly to try to get a pair of glasses redone, I know. It can be very costly, especially if there's not cooperation. So the fact that there's no regulatory body in charge of that in the state is a concern. Maybe we need to look into that, and maybe we work with you on that or others, I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to assist you in any information I can provide regarding that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next is the Board of Dentistry.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome.
My name is Marshall Fragg. I'm the Executive Director of the State Board of Dentistry. And I will be presenting the budget issues for the Board of Dentistry this morning, as well as for HPSP, the Health Professional Services Program, which is a program that all of the boards cooperate with, and we are acting as the administering board for that. First, with regard to the Board of Dentistry. Board of Dentistry has been around for a long time. It was established in 1885. We currently regulate about 16,000 dental professionals throughout the state, regulating dentists, dental hygienists, and dental assistants. Numbers of those professions keep growing. Things that we do as boards is to establish standards of education and testing requirements. We do those that are unique to the dental profession. We also address complaints and investigations in ways that are unique to the practice of dentistry. But with regard to trends in what we're seeing, the number of regulated professionals continues to increase. The number of complaints and the complexity of those complaints continues to rise. We do use online renewals, so computer-based services, and that continues to be the preferred method for dental professionals. At this point, we're getting close to 70% of our professionals renewing online, and that number keeps increasing. We audit the dental professional development portfolios, which is the continuing education requirements for dentists, and we just actually began doing those audits, changed our process in about 3 years ago, started the audit last year, and we're beginning to identify issues for licensees with regard to professional development. Throughout the state, dental access continues to be an issue, and that does impact the types of complaints that we get. While respectful of the governor and the budget proposal that he's presented, I must at this time address our own budget shortfall. Despite our boards retaining a small budget surplus within the special revenue fund, our request for a change item increase to maintain essential services related to public protection has not been included in the governor's proposal. We've continually worked to make ourselves efficient, effective, and relevant, streamlining procedures while increasing public protection. We did not spend on extravagances. We had requested additional spending authority to be able to maintain our staff so that safety efforts may continue. The Board of Dentistry hopes that the committee, the legislature, and the governor will recognize the value of the quality services provided by the board and the other boards and consider a base budget increase. Again, what do we do as a board? We set and enforce the standards for those entering the dental professions, working closely with educational institutions, accrediting bodies, regional and national examining institutions, and our connections with colleagues and other boards of dentistry across the country. We ensure continued competence by establishing and enforcing professional development requirements, and we respond to complaints, investigate those, and act on those complaints, as well as ensuring licensee compliance with remedial measures. We do this so that I, you, and all Minnesota citizens can be confident in the quality and the competence of the services that are provided by our dental professionals. As I said, in addition to our dental professions, our board has recently assumed responsibility for acting as the administering board for the Health Professional Services Program. Again, a resource that is shared by all of the health licensing boards and the Department of Health. If at this time you'd like to address any questions about the Board of Dentistry, and then I'll move on to HPSC, or if you'd like me to make comments on HPSC and take questions at the end, it's up.
Can we see if there's any questions first on the Board of Dentistry? Any questions or comments from committee members? I have a
question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question is, you inferred that there was a need for an increase in revenue stream. You currently get your budget through the special revenue source. Are you asking for a fee increase, or Can you explain that a little more?
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, what we requested was an increase in our spending authority. So the fee, we do not require a fee increase, and in fact, the last time we changed fees was in 1999, which was to lower fees. So we don't anticipate that, but we do have a surplus or reserve in the special revenue fund of monies that we've taken in through licensing fees. What we're asking is that we work together to establish an opportunity for the legislature to authorize additional spending out of that money. So again, it's not general revenue fund, it's money that we've generated through fees, and we need those additional monies in order to continue operations at the level that we do.
And Madam Speaker, follow up. And to that point, then, we have capped the amount we've capped your budget so that you cannot access those resources. Is that what I'm understanding?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, that's correct. We generate the revenues, but we're not permitted to spend them without legislative authorization.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Craig, what areas do you need the authorization in that you're not allowed to spend right now? Maybe it's something we can
Well, we've requested a cost item increase. Again, that was not considered through Department of Finance or the Governor's budget. That would increase primarily to manage salary and benefit increases that are inherent in having state staff. And so that's primarily what we're looking at. We've also looking at increasing costs of per diems for board members because of, again, increasing numbers of applicants, of licensees, and of complaints. Board members are spending more time on the work that they're doing. Our need for professional and technical contracts has also increased with, again, the complexity of the cases that we have, the need to hire expert witnesses for cases and for reviewing difficult cases. Computer services, our database continues to drain money from us. It's necessary to maintain that, but the cost of that continues to increase. In-state travel increases, again, because of board member activity. And the charges for the online processing are something that the board does absorb, and those costs are also increasing with the additional as that grows. So it's across the board, basically, that there are needs for increased spending in order to maintain services at what they are. If we are kept to the governor's proposed budget, which maintains our budget spending level at what it has been for the last year, what it would mean is that we would need to cut significantly, which in our case means cutting a staff member, which is more than, it's close to 15% of what our staff is. And that would mean that we then need to look very carefully at the services that we provide and the types of cases that we take on.
Can you tell me what your surplus is right now?
Our surplus currently stands at about $100,000.
And is it your testimony that if you were allowed to spend that, you would be spending it on maintaining your staff complement and increasing selling benefits, I guess the ones that are in the contract already?
Correct.
Okay, and then increasing costs that have to do with computers, state travel, per diem, technical. Is that what you're saying, all those areas?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And I think it would be helpful if we could actually see a breakdown. At least I'd like to see that.
Madam Chair, I do understand that on behalf of the Health Licensing Board that Julie Vangston has provided a letter with the change item increase request for all of the boards.
Okay.
Is that something that they have?
Is this something we've received?
To the other committee? That was provided to another committee. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but we'll make sure that you can get that.
We get it. Yeah, and I did want to ask you a little bit more about some of the complaints. I noticed that there's 68% of open complaint cases were resolved. That means a lot that still are not resolved. And that four of these were contested cases. And you did mention that the complaints are more complex. Could you just give us a picture of what you're talking about? What kind of complaints are we talking about here?
Madam Chair, the types of complaints that the Board of Dentistry has typically gotten over the past few years. The most common have to do with questions of competency, unprofessional conduct, sanitary and safety conditions, and fraud. The numbers of fraud cases has increased significantly with the Department of Human Services Fraud Department looking very carefully at the practices of dentists.
Madam Chair and Mr. Sherrick, just to refresh my memory, didn't we take some money out of your SRG and put it in the general fund 4 or 5 years ago with the approval of the Dental Association?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, there have been transfers out of the Special Revenue Fund into the general fund. I don't know that that was done necessarily with the board's approval or the association's approval, but that was what happened. I believe that's happened twice.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Sherrick, I think the money was used for a dental access kinds of problems, but I don't remember the details.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, there was some money from the money that was swept that was used for some dental access activities through, I believe, the Department of Health.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Schreck. I would just like to know, are you the only venue that patients have for complaints? Who else do they complain to if they feel that there's been, some of those safety violations? I know that I'd had some folks in my district that had gone through the board, and it took a rather long time. So I would just like you to speak to who else is out there and the time that is spent on resolving the complaint.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor. The public does have a number of venues, pathways to address complaints. One of those is the court system, which surprisingly is not utilized very often by patients. Another is through the Professional Association. The Minnesota Dental Association does have a peer review committee, which if the dentist that is that the issues are addressed against is a member of the Dental Association, then they're able to the patient is able to participate in that peer review process. Similarly, complaints do go to the Attorney General's office. When they go to the Attorney General's office, they typically are turned over to the board as well, and a complaint is opened. As far as the long time processing complaints, I think that we do average close to 2 years to address complaints on average. When we do get complaints that are easily resolved, those are easily resolved and done so within a few months. When they get caught up in investigations, the investigations are done through the Attorney General's office, which is backlogged. And we utilize the Attorney General's office for our counsel, and there are certainly delays because of that process. But then there are delays on the other end when we develop remedies for those issues, and we need to negotiate through attorneys to resolve those and come to an agreement.
Other questions? I have another question. How common is it for a dentist to require a patient to sign a waiver that they will never sue them for any treatment?
Madam Chair, that's, to my knowledge, that's very rare. We just heard about a case of that recently, and our counsel has advised us that we should not permit that to stop somebody from actually filing a complaint with the board.
So that individual will be able to go ahead and file a complaint?
They would, yes.
Okay. You want to go on to the second part of your
presentation? Thank you. The Health Professional Services Program is established collaboratively by the Health Licensing Board. It's designed to monitor the treatment and continuing care of health professionals who have either substance, psychiatric, or other medical disorders that may impact their ability to practice safely. HPSB's mission is to enhance public safety in healthcare. The goals of HPSB are to promote early intervention, diagnosis, and treatment for healthcare professionals with illnesses and provide monitoring services as an alternative to board discipline. Participation in the program has been growing steadily. Over the last 3.5 years, HPSB has experienced a 26% increase in participation. It's positive for public protection, but it strains program resources. There are currently 593 health professionals enrolled in the program. In fiscal year 2008, HPSB opened up 479 new cases and closed 449, an increase of 30, which is essentially one-third of a caseload. Caseloads are currently 15% higher than recommended levels. HPSB is nationally recognized for providing collaborative services to boards and for the comprehensiveness of their legislation, which has led to the appointment of Monica Feider, who unfortunately is not able to be here today to present this. She's been appointed to the Board of Directors for the National Federation of State Physician Health Programs. 96% of HPSB funding is from the Health Licensing Board. The remaining 4% is from the Department of Health and the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board for monitoring the professionals that they regulate. Roughly 90% of the HPSB budget is directed towards salaries and benefits. The remaining 10% covers rent, professional technical contracts, and other program operating costs. There's no room within HPSB to make up for inflationary increases other than by reducing staff, story that you've heard before, which would significantly impede their ability to meet statutory mandates. Therefore, HPSB has requested 3 change item increases that were not adopted by the governor. The first change item would enable the HPSB to maintain its current level of staffing. The second would increase the hours of a case aide position from a 0.6 position to a full-time FTE, and to add another case manager to increase the increase in demand for program services. The third request is relating to improving their technology so that they can provide more efficient services and provide more meaningful outcome measures, so improvements to their database. I have the specific numbers for the request that HPSB has introduced, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, Mr. Shrager, I guess it would be something we would be interested in getting those numbers. Can you provide those to the committee?
I sure will. The recommendations that HPSB has made, Madam Chair, are to maintain, in order to maintain the current staffing level, they've requested an increase in their base budget by $32,000 in fiscal year 10. And $62,000 in fiscal year 11. That would cover increases in salaries and benefits, rent, and other operations. And it would also be possible for HPSB then to provide the current level of services with less staff. Number two would be increased staffing to meet the increasing demand for services. In this scenario, increasing the base budget by $120,000 in fiscal year 10 and $125,000 in fiscal year 11 would enable HPSB to increase the hours of the case aide up from 0.6 to a full-time and to hire an additional case manager.
Excuse me, Mr. Shrag, I'm having trouble finding the budget items you're talking about. I have the dentistry board.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
And then, so this is separate.
Let me explain. The Health Professional Services Program had been under the administration of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, EMSRB. The executive director of EMSRB retired, and at the time that she retired, the board determined that the responsibility for administering HPSB would go to a different board. So currently, I think you've got the history under the EMSRB budget, and the what we're proposing is that be transferred to the dentistry budget.
Just a moment, I'm trying to find a budget page. So you think it'd be under the MSRB?
I believe so.
I think they're not in our booklet that I can see.
Madam Chair?
Did you find them? Somebody else find them?
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, is it part of the Emergency Medical Service Board? Is that what you're saying, Mr. Shrake?
Madam,
I think it might be in there.
That's correct.
Different page. Okay. Thank you, Representative McNair.
I was looking through it.
I apologize, Madam Chair, Representative, but I should have made that more clear.
Okay. All right, continue on.
Okay. So the second of the scenarios, again, increased the budget in order to increase staffing and hire and increase the staffing levels. And then the third scenario is to improve also increased funding by $60,000 in fiscal year 10 and an additional $5,000 in fiscal year 11, which will be the technology improvements in enhancing the program's database.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions from the members? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, the Board of Chiropractic, I believe. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Larry Spicer. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. And I thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. The Board of Chiropractic Examiners is a board that was established in 1919. It currently has 7 members, 5 of which are professional. That is, they are licensee members of the board. And 2 members are consumer members, or public members. I am currently in my 17th year as the executive director of the board, and I just would like to point out that during that time the board has been the subject of 2 awards for the outstanding licensing board in the country, outstanding chiropractic licensing board in the country, and the board members as part of that have reached national prominence. And I'm bringing this up for another reason that we'll I'll try to make clear in a moment, but one of the things that we have noticed is that things that we see in other areas of the country, we are going to see in Minnesota. So there is great value in the board members being tapped into the national scene and understanding what's going on with other boards across the country. We currently have in just about 2,700 chiropractic licenses, and in addition to that, approximately 1,300 additional or subordinate registrations. Registrations such as acupuncture, professional firm, independent examiners, and this legislature in its wisdom saw fit last year to establish animal chiropractic. And so we now currently have registered 5 persons to perform services with animals, of course, given the proper conditions, the right kind of training and follow-up. We also provide online services. As a matter of fact, the Board of Chiropractic was the second agency in the state of Minnesota to allow for online services, the first being the Department of Public Safety with driver's licenses. The Board of Chiropractic was next in allowing for the renewal of licenses online. We are currently continue to nip at the heels of about 90% utilization of that service. The boards, as a practical matter, members of the committee, when you speak to any of the executive directors and ask them in general what are their board functions, they will, for the most part, tell you the boards have 2 primary functions. That is that we license individuals to perform services in the state, and then secondly, we enforce the practice, the various practice acts, or others will refer to that as complaint resolution. And that can occur on a rather wide continuum, anywhere from simple correction to, if necessary, discipline, even to the extent of revocation or suspension of a license, if that is deemed appropriate in that particular case. There are, in essence, at least for the Board of Chiropractic, there are 3 issues primarily that have affected our expenditures over time. First of all, there are this increase in costs across the board, as was mentioned earlier by one of my colleagues, salaries, which are mandated by contractual requirements. So there are increases in salaries. There are increases in costs to the Attorney General's office. There are increases in rent. And just essentially, ladies and gentlemen, all of our costs go up, and we are obligated to meet those costs. The second thing that impacts our expenditures are frankly an increase in the severity and in the complexity of the types of cases that we're handling as a regulatory board. And I don't believe that this is confined to the chiropractic board, but certainly we are seeing it. And the third thing, of course, that has affected our expenditures or our budget overall is, as has been mentioned earlier, the transfer of funds from the special revenue fund to the general fund. Quite frankly, in spite of the fact that we are dealing with some contested case issues, as the chiropractic board, we have been running pretty close to revenue neutral, although we did get slapped with a pretty substantial contested case hearing year before last, and right about that same time, not too long before that, we got hit with the first transfer of the general revenue fund to the general revenue fund. That threw us into deficit spending, and we have never really quite recovered from that. And then in the meantime, here we are again in this last year, it happened again. So this has put us into sort of a negative status from which we are continuing to try to recover. We have, quite frankly, hit the wall. And so I would point out to you, as I mentioned earlier, I've been with the board in excess of 16 years. I'm in my 17th year. We have never raised fees in that entire time. We are, for the first time, coming to the legislature or through the governor's budget asking for a raise in fees. I feel that we have done everything we can do to cut costs, to be creative and what have you, to maintain our budget. But, you know, eventually you reach the limitations of matter, and that's where you are. So we have we have requested some change items. Those change items are being requested for the purposes of catching up to handle our deficit, and secondly, to maintain ongoing operations. As a general matter, any continued stagnation in our finances are going to impact one of those two functions I mentioned earlier. It's either going to impact our ability to license people, or it's going to impact our ability to resolve complaints. The committee asked Mr. Schrag a moment ago about the length of time that it's taking to resolve some of this complaint. And I believe he said this, but I would like to emphasize that to the degree that we are restricted from using funds that are available to us, or to the degree that we are unable to acquire funds, that is going to have an impact primarily on our enforcement capabilities. It puts us in a position of having to be more discretionary in terms of what types of cases we are able to handle and how we're able to investigate them and bring them to conclusion. This is existing in an environment in which I believe defense attorneys are becoming more savvy and more, frankly, aware of some of the travails that the boards are dealing with regard to their financial conditions. And we have seen evidence that some of the attorneys are sort of creating stalling tactics with the boards, because they know if they do this long enough, if the boards have limited budgets, they will eventually be put into a position where they may not be able to handle this type of case. Having said that, ladies and gentlemen, that brings me to the end of my comments, and I would be glad to stand for any questions the committee may have.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Spicer, I have a question on the other operating expenses, where it almost tripled in fiscal year 2009 from 2008. Is that related to the contested case you were talking about?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, almost exclusively representing contested case hearings. We, in all that time I've been with the board, we had only previously experienced one contested case hearing. We were quite adept at negotiating resolutions. This last year we saw a very significant contested case hearing, and I'm staring down the barrel of at least two and possibly three more.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up, Dr. Spicer, so what kind of expenses do you incur? Is it expert witnesses, or what are the expenses that that you actually incur?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the expenses we incur primarily are, if we're required to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings, then we have to pay for those services. So we have to pay the court costs, the legal assistance costs. We have to pay significant costs to the Attorney General, as they are our legal representative. But before we even get there, we often have to pay very significant costs in terms of investigations, which is another thing, by the way, as Mr. Schrag was asked earlier about time delays. sometimes investigations can take a considerable length of time, and that passes out of our hands until it's concluded and brought back to the board with the final product.
Madam Chair, one more follow-up. And then what about restitution from the practitioner if there's deemed to be fault or something? Do you have any restitution possibilities?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the short answer to that is yes. The longer answer is, however, it is subject to certain limitations. For example, the Board of Chiropractic is limited to $10,000 per violation found with a practitioner. Some number of years ago, this legislature came to the boards and said, we frankly want you to be more aggressive in how you charge for those costs. And we said, fine, we're more than happy to do that. And the legislature also established some additional language to clarify what it is that we could recover costs for. They did that, but nevertheless, there are some legal opinions out that suggest that we can only go so far because to do so may, in fact, impinge on the defendant's constitutional rights. So we are held to certain limitations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is the gist of it you won't be recovering any of these costs?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I apologize if I left you with that. No, we do recover a fair amount of cost. We can just never recover anywhere close to what it really costs us if we go to a contested case hearing. If I might, by way of example, a contested case hearing, which was very significant, and when all costs were put together, recently cost us close to $200,000. We were able to recover from this $30,000.
Madam Chair, I have an unrelated question. Dr. Spicer, you mentioned that you've now licensed 5 animal chiropractic practices. Have you had any complaints since they've been licensed?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the answer is no. However, to be honest, it's very early. We've only been registering them now for a few months. It would be highly unlikely that that would happen, but I would also hope it would not happen.
Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Spicer, I just wanted to follow up on, I think you inferred that that defense attorneys know that your budget is limited, and so they now are developing strategies to push these cases to go beyond the negotiation but to the administrative hearing. Can you kind of give us some evidence of that? I need to better understand that.
Yeah, can I give you evidence of that? No, I can't. It's one of those things you sort of hear in the wind from hallway talk, shall we say. But we have had, it seems like a higher number of cases, particularly in the last 2 years, and I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, particularly in the last 2 years where it seems like we are getting more direct threats in our negotiations to simply take the matter to contested case hearings. In speaking with other people, we have been led to believe that it's because they've come to understand that they understand we have budget constraints.
Yeah, I guess that's with the lack of evidence, are really starting to understand that. I mean, I think that doesn't necessarily sit well with me. I mean, there could be an anomaly, these things run in cycles, you get more and less in some decades than others. I imagine you've been doing this a long time. Or, I mean, I think that that's kind of dangerous to say without really being able to show some evidence or to really understand that, to say that defense attorney's tactics is simply to push this to the administrative process or go beyond the normal process that you've been doing, to go to the administrative process as a way to try to get you to back off of their client. I guess I would just caution, you know, those comments until we can really quantify or find some evidence that that is so.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I accept your caution in good faith. Thank you. I'll keep that in mind.
Dr. Spicer, I do have a question. Both you and Chief Witness talk about these complaints being much more complex. Could you tell me what you mean by that, or maybe give an example? or two of what you're talking about?
Yes, Madam Chair, we're seeing more complaints in the area of sexual misconduct and overutilization. And interestingly enough, the types of complaints that we're seeing, and also in advertising, the types of complaints that we're seeing in overutilization seem to stem largely, in some of the cases that we're dealing with, from different approaches of practitioners trying to survive in a somewhat hostile healthcare reimbursement environment. It becomes more difficult for them to acquire reimbursement, and so they're making choices that are probably not in their best interest. In addition to that, some of the policies change with the reimbursement or third-party payers, and sometimes the licensee is not aware of that and runs a number of cases or carries a number of cases with policies that may run afoul of those, and then later on the third-party payers will complain to us and we're having to deal with those. We are dealing now with some cases that are reimbursement cases dealing with millions of dollars, which we have not had to do in the past.
Okay, so reimbursement for long-term treatment or reimbursement for certain kinds of treatment?
Well, I would say both, Madam Chair. It would be reimbursement for certain types of treatments that the insurance companies have taken the position that they're not responsible for. And in other cases, it's reimbursement for chiropractors treating patients for longer periods of time than the third-party payers believe is reasonable.
I think one of the issues that has been raised over a period of time with some of the access issues to chiropractic have been the cost-benefit of chiropractic as compared to certain other modalities, and I'm just wondering if you care to comment on that.
Well, we have to, Madam Chair, we have to remain cognizant of the fact that the types of complaints that we're talking about or the people that we're talking about represent a very small portion of the profession. We're talking about a couple of percent. So the reality is that the large percent of practitioners are out there and they're doing a good job and have decent relationships with the insurance companies and don't run afoul of these types of complaints. I would juxtapose that with numerous studies, which I would be glad to provide for the committee, that have taken place over 20 or 30 years that have continued to compare medical costs versus chiropractic costs and have continued to find almost universally that traditional chiropractic care for certain types of conditions is very close to 50% of what it costs for these same cases to enter the medical community. And that's largely derived from the fact that we don't do surgery, which is a very expensive proposition, and we don't use hospitalization, which is also very expensive.
Thank you. I wanted to give you a chance to say that because I think there's been some efforts to cut back on access to chiropractic both at the state and federal level. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, as a practical matter, I would consider that relatively, please forgive me, I would consider that relatively short-sighted because the continued, as I said, almost every research study that I've seen done by qualified people, and most of which are in the medical community, have come to a different conclusion. But I think the competition for the healthcare dollar is getting more and more stiff.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments or questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Haiti.
Let's see, Board of Veterinary Medicine. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. John King. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. I could make my presentation very short by saying what Dr. Spicer said. The same things that the Board of Veterinary Medicine is seeing is what the other health licensing boards are seeing. The Board of Veterinary Medicine is one of the older boards established in 1883. It's made up of seven citizens appointed by the governor, five are veterinarians, two are non-veterinarians. The Board of Veterinary Medicine regulates somewhere north of 3,000 licensed veterinarians that have a Minnesota license. The Board of Veterinary Medicine is seeing or has seen a gradual increase in the number of licensees and also an increase in the number of complaints and the complexity of those complaints. The Board of Veterinary Medicine engages and provides a lot of electronic government services to both the licensees and the citizens of Minnesota, be it online license renewal, access to license verification by consumers, access to a complaint form should they have concerns regarding the competency or standard of care of a practitioner. Board of Veterinary Medicine also utilizes, with the other 14 health licensing boards, a common agency administrative services unit, which uses, which provides common backroom business functions for all the health licensing boards, like payroll, contracts, HR, purchasing, accounts receivable. And that way, it allows the boards to spend their time and resources on the area of expertise, which are the licensees and the complaints in that area. The Board of Veterinary Medicine, through the budgeting process with finance and the governor's office, had two change item requests. One was included in the governor's budget, and that is the one that's before you, and that is for the increase in fees. The Board of Veterinary Medicine, like all the other health licensing boards, is special revenue funded. We gather no general fund dollars, and we must, by law, neither significantly overcollect or undercollect, and remain as close to revenue neutral as possible. The need to increase licensing fees have come about to offset an agency fund deficit, and that deficit has come about by four things. Two were unanticipated and unbudgeted contested cases. One was the Board of Veterinary Medicine found itself defending in court a lawsuit regarding challenging the constitutionality of the laws that govern veterinary medicine in the state of Minnesota. And also, two of the last three bienniums, money was transferred from the Special Revenue Fund into the general fund, and that money is appropriated back to the individual board. In short, that's why we need the fee increase. We are experiencing the same increase in costs within the boards as the other agencies, as Mr. Schrag and Dr. Spicer has alluded to, that the modest request to increase the base budget was not included in the governor's budget, but yet we support his budget. So we're before you requesting an increase in licensing fees to hopefully remain revenue neutral. The last fee increase in the Board of Veterinary Medicine was in 1997. And this fee increase, if approved and passed, would go into effect 2010, so it would be 13 years. I'd be happy to answer any questions, should the committee have some.
Thank you. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry. Dr. King, there, should have prepared. My question to you is regarding the makeup of the board with regard to large animal rural vets versus pet vets or small animals. I guess there have been some concerns with regard to that, and I would like to know, just hear a little bit more about the direction the board anticipates going with regard to the makeup of that, and also any complaints that you've been hearing from around the state regarding that issue. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Faisal?
Faisal.
Sorry about that. I'd be happy to address that. First of all, the members of the board are appointed by the governor, by their appointment secretary. The board does not have, per se, does not choose who's there or not. It's through the open appointments process. That said, the Board of Veterinary Medicine has always worked diligently to maintain diversity of the board as far as representing gender diversity, representing in-state versus metro, or metro versus greater Minnesota diversity, and also representing the reflecting the cases or the type of complaints that the Board of Veterinary Medicine has. There's always been at least three members of the board that have resided outside the nine-county metro area. always. So, that is, we've encouraged the appointment secretary to maintain that diversity, and that's important because we deal with complaints. The vast majority of the complaints are regarding companion animals, but there are some that regard, that address food animal production, equine. So we need to maintain that diversity of members of the board that review this. And we are cognizant and have always addressed it and still do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. King, I wonder if, since this board was begun back in 1983, yes. Anyway, it's been around for a long time. Presumably it's had the same makeup of five members. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm wondering if you see any need actually to expand that number based on the fact that we have, you know, livestock operations obviously are going down in comparison to some of the other, you know, veterinary requests. But I'm just wondering, you know, we've got the equine situation. We have certainly a lot more pets these days than back then. Do you feel that five members can adequately address all of the issues, or do you feel constrained by the fact that it's five members? Mr. King?
Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, there's seven members of the board. Five are veterinarians, two are public members, first of all. Second, the board has not had any problem meeting the needs and addressing the complaints presented with the number of board members they have. However, that is not necessarily the perception of individuals in greater Minnesota. The Board of Veterinary Medicine would be happy if directed to or through legislation to increase the number of the members of the board. What I ask you is, please provide the money to do that. We need it costs $125 to bring our board member from Duluth down here. Okay, and we need to have the ability to have per diem, travel expenses for these individuals, and be able to have. Do the job that we need to do. We're happy to work with what the legislature gives us, but we're limited by what we can do by funding at times. Show me the money.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. King, I guess I got a couple questions for you here. One would be, when you say that you need increased revenue, can you give us your current licensing fees? I see it's got a little over 3,000 members of the veterinary board. What that current price is and what the fee anticipated to meet that need would be?
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, currently and for the past, since 1997, the licensing fees have been at $200 for 2 years. So and we renew every 2 years. And the projection would be go up to $280 per 2 years.
Okay. And a follow-up, madam? And the other question was, I know that in legislation last year we had incorporated the animal chiropractic provision. Does that fall under your purview, or is that a separate total provision, do you know?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Severson, that is administered by the Board of Chiropractic Medicine because that law, that legislation provided for licensed chiropractors with additional training to work on animals. So that they are licensees of the chiropractic board, and it's not under our purview. Board of Veterinary Medicine deals with the unlicensed individuals, the non-chiropractors, non-veterinarians, at times are out there doing work on animals and at times causing harm.
We'll follow up, Madam Chair. And I guess to that point, have you had any feedback, Dr. King, on in terms of the practice for animal chiropractic, and how has that affected the number of calls on your veterinary services, or is there a working relationship between the two?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Severson, there has not been an increased number of complaints or anything like that. The Board of Veterinary Medicine and all the health licensing boards, along with the Board of Chiropractor are all in the same building. We work collaboratively always. The Board of Veterinary Medicine has helped or been involved with the rule writing process, and the Chiro Board addressing animal chiropractic issues. The Board of Veterinary Medicine would likely be included should there be a complaint against a human chiropractor regarding their care they're providing to animals. There's not been an increase in number of complaints regarding chiropractic services to the Board of Veterinary Medicine on veterinarians doing it or chiropractors doing it, licensed chiropractors. So we've seen no net increase, but we're early in the process as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I was noticing that you do have a 70% increase in the number of consumer complaints. That's since 1998. Has that leveled off lately, or that 98 is a ways back, or is it continuing to increase like the other boards?
Excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the increase has been slow and steady increase brought about by many factors, I believe. That for the last couple of years, it's been around 90-ish or so, but depending on influences and factors of the public, and if you look at national trends, complaint numbers have increased.
And Sexton, could you just tell us a little bit more about the nature of those increased complaints? There is a trend, or?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's been, the kinds of complaints we get are similar to some of the other boards regarding standard of care issues, competency issues. There's five components that go into every or that are part of every complaint to some degree or another, and it's communication, the veterinarian was rude, the dog died, there's a big bill, the dog is a member of my family, and blame must be assigned. And those are all components that contribute to a complaint. Some weighted heavier than others in a complaint. But most of the complaints are regarding competency, standard of care as a basis. Some communication issues or miscommunication issues as well.
Ned, I think you mentioned that you also are involved in the large animal operations. Is that correct? The factory farm type operation?
Madam Chair, the Board of Veterinary Medicine regulates veterinarians. It's not involved in large-scale production medicine. So we regulate the veterinarians that may work there, but do not have any influence over those production systems.
And are there any of the complaints related to those operations of your veterinarians in those facilities?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are very, very few complaints regarding food animal veterinarians, and none of them, to the best of my knowledge, have been regarding large-scale animal operations and egg production systems.
I know there's been some federal investigation of some of the treatment of some of those animals. I'm just wondering if your veterinarians were involved in all. It sounds like they've probably not been involved. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the complaints have been about, I think what you're referring to is humane care and care of the employees of those facilities to the animals they have. The veterinarians have not been identified in any of those complaints that I'm aware of, and none of those complaints have made their way to the board regarding veterinarians authorizing inhumane care. In fact, it's almost always the opposite. The veterinarian is looking out for the behalf of the animal, not necessarily to cause harm.
Thank you. I would hope that would be the case, and I was thinking that might be the case, and that you might be involved on that side of it in some regard.
Madam Chair, no, ma'am. There's not been any complaints or anything involved that has identified veterinarians' involvement in inhumane care and in large-scale egg production systems.
I think my question wasn't quite understood. Are veterinarians involved in any kind of reporting of those conditions? Is that part of the ethical code of veterinarians when they see those kinds of conditions that they report them? That's my question.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand your question. There is a requirement in regulation that veterinarians must report direct knowledge of inhumane care and stage animal fighting, and there has not been those complaints. Again, it hinges on direct knowledge and the definition of that, and you know, things may happen when the veterinarians, you know, visit these large-scale production facilities once a week or more or less, but they're not there all the time, and some of these things that happen may not be happening when the veterinarian is there and can have direct knowledge of that.
Okay, I just want to see if I understood. There's a ethical requirement in terms of stage animal fighting, but how about in terms of basically raising the humane or lack of humane care in some of these operations? Is there an ethical requirement for veterinarians to report that?
Madam Chair, the veterinarians are obligated to report direct knowledge of inhumane care and stage animal fighting. So they're obligated to do both of those things. So the inhumane care, that's handled through the sheriff's department and the local attorney, because that's a criminal nature. So the veterinarian is obligated to report it to humane officers, county authorities, and they can. But there has not been any reports directly to the Board of Veterinary Medicine regarding inhumane care of animals at a production facility.
And that's outside of your purview, I take it. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. That those are inhumane care of animals is a felony, is a criminal offense, and it's not within the administrative purview of the Board of Veterinary Medicine that regulates veterinarians. Now, should a veterinarian have direct knowledge and not report this, and it comes to the attention of the board, action could be taken on that veterinarian, but that has not been the case thus far.
Okay. And did I hear you say that the constitutionality of the veterinary board was being contested? That cost you a lot of money, or was it constitutionality of what? I wasn't quite sure I heard that.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to explain. In 2005, there was a bill that went through that would change the laws providing for non-veterinarians to float horse teeth.
Oh, excuse me.
And individuals that did not meet the requirements aligned with a national libertarian legal team suing the Board of Veterinary Medicine, challenging the constitutionality of the regulation of horse teeth floaters. That cost the veterinarians of Minnesota in excess of $200,000 to defend that in court.
Thank you. I think we can move on now unless there's any other questions. Representative McNamara?
Madam Chair, just two questions. To follow up on Representative Saylor's, how many of the five veterinarians currently on the board see large animals?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, there would be two right now, two of five.
Madam Chair, do they exclusively see large animals, or do they have a dual practice?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, they have a dual, they're in mixed animal practice.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, if I can ask just one more. Dr. King, you're the executive director. I'm assuming you're a veterinarian doctor.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, that is correct.
I guess that does say that. Excuse me, it does say that here. Are you allowed as part? Is yours a full time position currently, and are you allowed to practice veterinary medicine outside of your current position with the board?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, my position is a 3/4 time position. The Board of Veterinary Medicine has a total of 1.75 FTEs, and I'm the 0.75. Yes, I do practice. I work for the state 4 days a week. I do practice 2 days a week. And there's nothing prohibited, nor is there any policy or concerns that have been addressed, that have been raised by the board about that.
Madam Chair, I'm actually in the other direction. I'd like to see you do more practice, because I think you'll know more about what's going on in the real world. And I'm wondering if, in our efforts to streamline things, if a potential
would be to allow you to practice more, where you'd probably make more money and we'd save the state money and you still could administer the one person. That was more just a comment, Madam Chair, and I'll let it go.
Madam Chair,
yes.
If I may respond to that, hallelujah. I've been a licensed veterinarian and practicing for 20 years. I've owned a business. I've practiced full-time. I have a very good understanding of what happens in the real world, and I practice in greater Minnesota, so outside the nine-county metro area. So I appreciate that, and there is a considerable value, I feel, for knowing what happens in the industry and administering that board.
Thank you, Beth King. Reverend Hayden?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Next we have our Board of Behavioral Health and Therapies.
I'm reminded that we have three boards left because we have the boards of podiatry last. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Rexigal, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, or BBHT, as we call it for short. The BBHT is quite a new board. It was created in 2003, and it regulates the practice of professional counseling and alcohol and drug counseling in Minnesota. And professional counselors may be licensed as licensed professional counselors or licensed professional clinical counselors, and they are master's level mental health counselors employed in a variety of settings, and they provide mental health counseling services to adults, families, and children in Minnesota. Alcohol and drug counselors, or LADCs, provide counseling services to persons relative to the abuse of or the dependency on alcohol or other drugs. The BBHT is not requesting any change items this session. Major change items were considered in the 2007 session, and they were rather painful in that our base budget was cut 41.5% 2 years ago, and at that same time, licensure fees for professional counselors were increased. And as you might imagine, the biggest challenge for a small board like the BBHT is recovering program debt. And unlike another board that you heard from earlier, the estimates for our licensees were only probably less than half of what was projected. And so with fewer licensees than projected and costs for startup of office equipment, staff, rulemaking, and database, we have a big challenge with our budget. Probably it's also our greatest achievement in the last 2 years in that we were able to apply over $400,000, $440,748 in excess of expenditures back towards the program debt. At the present time, the board regulates approximately 2,700 licensees. We have 560 licensed professional counselors, 33 licensed professional clinical counselors, 1,916 LADCs, and 214 alcohol and drug counselor temporary permit holders. The permit holders are primarily people coming in from other states or new students just graduating. And like the other health licensing boards, the BBHT is funded through fees paid by applicants and licensees and those deposited in the special revenue fund. Our base budgets are very small, $144,000 annual budget for the LPC program and a $250,000 annual budget for the LADC program. We are fortunate to share payroll, HR, IT, purchasing, et cetera, services with the other boards through the admin services unit. Our board office is staffed with three full-time employees, and we have a 13-member board. We have five professional counselors on the board, five like alcohol and drug counselors, and three public members. Our mission is to protect the public through effective licensure and enforcement of statutes and rules governing the practices of professional counseling and alcohol and drug counseling in Minnesota. Our operating statutes are 148B
.50 to 148B593, Chapter 148C, and Minnesota Rules Chapters 47, 47, and 2150. In addition to the challenge we have with debt recovery, the board has been hampered by not having a full complement of board members for most of the last 5 years. And currently we only have 9 of the 13 board member positions filled. And that's difficult because we rely on our board members to work on the various board committees to process complaints, help with the application process, and the like. Since licensure was created for the professional counselors in 2003 and the clinical license in 2007, the counselors in Minnesota have struggled for recognition in employment and reimbursement from insurance companies and the state of Minnesota, despite the rigorous education and supervision standards they have to meet to obtain licensure. So it's been a difficult journey from 03 to the present, and we've accomplished many things, and we're working to continue that work. The alcohol and drug counselors have an interesting history. The first licenses were issued in 1998, and that program was regulated by the Department of Health at that time. And when the new board was created in 2003, part of that arrangement was that the alcohol and drug counselors would transfer to the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy July 1, 2005. And when the LADCs came to the BBHT, they came with a $1 million plus debt, 263 open complaint files. And the Department of Health ran the program with 3 1/3 full-time employees. For the last 3 years, BBHT has run the program with 2 full-time employees. So because of the budget challenge, we really do not have an adequate staffing level to provide good customer service, and that is our chief complaint. It takes much, much longer to process applications. Ideally, we would have 5 full-time employees to administer these 2 programs, but we just can't do it with the plan we're on to recover our debt. And as I mentioned before, the board is on target to retire the LADC program debt by 2013. It's approximately half of what it was when we got the program. And the counseling program is now generating revenue in excess of its expenditures and beginning to chip away at the startup debt that was incurred. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy and the challenges that we have.
Questions from committee members? Well, I did have one. Did you say the debt was brought to you partly from the LADC, the folks transferred over from the Department of Health? Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The licensing programs have separate funding, and so one license does not pay for the other one, so to speak. They have separate revenue source codes, etc. The LADC program standalone debt was over $1 million. I think at the end of fiscal year 08, the professional counselor program debt was approximately $498,000.
So, in an ongoing way, are the complaints that are coming into you more in the area of one versus the other today?
Madam Chair, the majority of complaints that the board receives are against alcohol, licensed alcohol and drug counselors. We receive very few complaints, probably 10 or less per year, against professional counselors.
And could you describe if there is a major trend in terms of those complaints, please?
Madam Chair, thank you. The bulk of the complaints that we receive are competency and unprofessional conduct type of complaints, breach of client confidentiality, inappropriate boundaries with clients, poor record keeping, and and the like. I mean, the most serious would be a sexual relationship with a client.
And there's certain facilities or types of facilities that seem to have more, generate more of those complaints than others?
Madam Chair, the Department of Human Services licenses alcohol and drug counseling facilities. They do the facility licensing. I'm not aware that any particular facility, whether it be, you know, for juveniles or adults or programs within organizations, I'm not aware that any type of facility generates more complaints.
I guess I'm asking in regard to the individuals, do they tend to be more in certain types of facilities than others? Is your answer the same? Or?
Madam Chair, the majority of our alcohol and drug counselors work in licensed facilities, so I don't have any information.
That's something you'd be willing to check on to see if there is any sort of trend, just to see if there are some types of facilities that tend to have more. I'm worried about some of the supervision, and it sounds like you have your way understaffed in terms of follow-up. And I've received a certain number of complaints regarding certain facilities, so I'm just wondering if you could check on that for me and see if there's any light you can shed on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will contact the Department of Human Services and try to get you a copy of person.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Some complaints?
Well, I was aware of the start of this board before I came on this job. And it sounds like it's having troubles in the beginning here, but partly it seems because you were given also the alcohol and drug counselor. Is that why you have trouble filling the board? Is the board appointed by the governor, as the other boards have spoken of, or do people volunteer? And is it difficult to be on the board to maintain a professional organization because you don't have the funding to do the job? And so it's discouraging. I hear a lot of discouragement in your voice.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Lane, thank you. First of all, like the other health licensing boards, our board members are appointed by the governor's office, appointments department secretary. I had a recent meeting at the governor's office, and I was assured that our four vacancies would be filled in the very near future. I think there's a lot of interest in serving on the board. I don't see that as an issue. I've had many people inquire about how to get on the board. I can only attribute it to staffing issues at the governor's office. It's, you know, a very small board and just one of the many jobs that they have to do to fill positions on a board.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's see if we can hear from the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. And while we're waiting for, I think it's Catherine Burke-Moore, I believe. Okay. Now, there's minutes of three meetings that we need to look at. Has someone who's been diligently looking at those minutes? Representative Rosenthal, it looks like you might be a good candidate to tell me if those minutes are in order. Thank you. Representative Rosenthal moves those minutes be approved. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Vankless. I'm the accounting coordinator for the Administrative Services Unit of the Health Related Licensing Board. I'm here to represent Kathy Burke-Moore today. She was unable to attend. And I don't have information about her board so much as just to let you know that there are no change requests included in the governor's budget for her board. And I'd be happy to bring back any questions that you may have directly related to her board.
All right. Any questions, comments? Bring back? If not, okay. Thank you for your support and that presentation. We do have someone from the Podiatric Board, I believe. This will be our last presentation today. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Keith Hublin, Executive Director of the Board of Podiatric Medicine. Thank you for adding me to the agenda today. I was out of town last week when this was originally scheduled, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you directly. Podiatrists specialize in treating ailments of the toe and the foot and the lower leg below the bump, below the knee, or just below the tibial tuberosity is the technical term. There's a national trend in healthcare to refer more and more foot care issues directly to doctors of podiatric medicine. In the early days, most podiatrists practiced in a private practice setting. Now many podiatrists are on staff in hospitals and other healthcare facilities. The board receives about a dozen complaints each year, and the trend has been fairly constant. Most complaints regarding unfavorable surgical outcomes and excessive billing. Complaints are often very complex, and it's difficult to resolve, but the board has been able to resolve all complaints in recent history through board orders for disciplinary action, for agreements for corrective action, without any contested case hearings, although we have a current complaint that may end up in a contested case hearing later this year. The board's cooperation is similar to that described by other executive directors, as you've already heard. If I could give one more example of this cooperation, the health-related boards in this last year were a national runner-up for a national award for state agencies, and this is a national competition among all 50 states, and our national boards were submitted in an area for disaster backup and recovery of computer operations, and by working together, we have reduced the overall cost of our computer operations, improved our day-to-day operations, and also improved our ability to recover computer operations, which are essential for board operations in the event of a major disaster such as a tornado or flooding or something else of that nature. My request is simply for the base budget as found in your budget materials that you already have, and I thank you for this time to speak with you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions?
I guess not.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for your concern. Cleanup, I did just have passed out a reminder that tonight is the first issue on first kind of learning session, we're calling it, on housing, and it's over at the League of Cities starting at 7:30. There'll be supper served at David's cost of $5. And foreclosure, homelessness, workforce housing, home. This is the topic from the folks that will be there, and I encourage you all to attend. These folks, I think, will probably be in a pretty good position, too, to start helping us understand what some of the federal dollars that are coming in and how that might impact our opportunities or not. That's just all coming forward, so this might be our first shot at learning about that. So I encourage you all to attend, and it's the first one is tonight, and then there'll be another one on the 24th. So, any questions about that? Okay. The meeting is adjourned. We'll meet again tomorrow.